Welcome to Not Your Boyfriend Sports Show. I'm Bryn.
And I'm Maeve. And this week on the show, Ronda Rousey is taken down while Russia is doping up. And for our feature this week, we're looking at the modern era of athlete activism, the causes, the controversy, and the players at the helm. Then it's another fierce lady. Okay, Bryn, start it off. This week in sports, what is Russia up to?
There was some unbelievable stuff that came out about Russia this week. So a report released by the World Anti-Doping Agency detailed hundreds of allegations against athletes, coaches, trainers, doctors, and other various Russian institutions, laying out what's being called the most extensive state-run doping program since the notorious East German regime of the 1970s.
Oh,
so basically what happened was that members of Russia's Secret Service intimidated workers at the drug testing lab to cover up the top athletes' positive results. They impersonated lab engineers at the Winter Olympics in Sochi, and there were like 1,400 lab samples that were destroyed to protect the athletes.
Wow.
So on top of that, athletes adopted false identities to avoid unexpected testing. They paid to make doping violations disappear. They bribed the anti-doping authorities to ensure favorable results. And top sports officials routinely submitted bogus urine samples for athletes who were doping. So it's like this unbelievably broad spanning conspiracy for Russian athletes to succeed.
Wow. Well, it sounds like some Cold War shit.
Yeah, seriously. It's crazy.
Well, in another crazy moment from sports this week, there was a surprise upset last night as Holly Holm beat crowd and really world favorite Ronda Rousey to win the UFC Bantamweight Championship. This is Rousey's first ever loss in her UFC career, and it happened 59 seconds into the second round when Holm delivered a crushing head kick that knocked Rousey to the mat. And it really seems like Holm's preparation paid off. She had obviously studied Rousey's patterns and techniques, and she avoided a lot of the major pitfalls that have led other challenges to fail. And Rousey's known for this armbar submission technique, which we've talked about on an earlier episode when she was our fierce lady. And she's really executed this flawlessly in many of her previous matches, but she just never really got the opportunity this time. So she usually defeats her opponents in under 20 seconds, and this time she got beat in, you know, a round in 59 seconds.
Yeah. And I, like, didn't watch the entire thing, but I saw a couple of clips of this, and it was unbelievable to see Ronda Rousey flounder, because normally we're so used to seeing her just completely dominate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, her nose was bloodied. She just seemed off kilter. She was letting herself get a couple good jabs in the face, and then, you know, this kick just finished her. So a big, big upset and a big, big surprise for Rousey, who's really been on quite the winning streak.
Yeah, pretty wild.
Okay, well, that does it for this week in sports. And when we come back, we will be talking about athletes and activism.
Welcome back. So today we're talking about athletes engaging in social movements or speaking out on social issues because they're in a really interesting corner of celebrity where athletes are not expected to have opinions on everything going on in the news, but they also have the opportunity to leverage their fame and their influence when they feel so compelled. So the majority of this episode is going to center around race and how athletes have spoken out, joined movements, and taken stands against racism in the U.S. The events that really prompted us to do this episode in the first place were the recent demonstrations at the University of Missouri. It's been all over the news, but essentially what happened is that since December, there have been a number of student-led demonstrations in order to get the Mizzou School Administration to take a stand on what people are calling the persistent racism on campus. So in the last few months, there were rallies held. Students and faculty conducted a sit-in to protest the university's inaction. The most prominent student activist group, called Concerned Student 1950, issued a list of demands calling for the president's resignation, as well as increased hiring of people of color. And a graduate student even went on a hunger strike, saying that he wouldn't eat until the president of the university resigned. So where athletics comes in is that 30 Black football players joined the protests, refusing to participate in football activities until the president stepped down. And the next day, the rest of the team, the coaches, the athletic director, all joined them in support of the movement, you know, presenting a united front as a team and saying that there would be no more football practice and they wouldn't play in any games until the president resigned. So there's also this added element that if the football team continued to refuse to play, the university would have to forfeit their games, and that comes with a really hefty penalty. They'd have to pay $1 million to BYU if Mizzou didn't play their game this past weekend. So essentially, 2 days after the football team joined the protests, the university president resigned and the chancellor was demoted as well. So this is a good example of athletes asserting the authority that they know they have, you know, standing up for a cause and adding not only monetary pressure, but also the national media attention that comes with being a high profile athletic organization.
Yeah, I think it especially spoke to the really specific dynamics in college sports that so much of the national attention colleges receive are because of their sports. And the athletes on this football team use that really wisely. And their participation really launched this into the national conscience. And I was listening to another podcast that Dave Zirin does, and he made the really good point that, you know, 7% of Mizzou's student body is Black, but something like 73% of their football team is. And so, especially when their coach came out in support of them and said, we're not going to be practicing, we're not going to be playing until this situation is resolved, that the coach, A, made the right move on kind of a moral spectrum, but also made the really smart and wise decision, because if you don't have your players behind you, then your whole program's going to fall apart.
Yeah, and there's actually this amazing video that I just saw that we'll have to post on our social media. After the president resigned, Mizzou did play their game against BYU, and they won it. And the coach was being interviewed after the game, and he was talking about how emotional this week has been. And his players just come up behind him and they're dancing and they're like chanting his initials and they're all crowding around him. And then they like pull him away from the reporter and they're just like, we love you, coach. Like, and he's like, I love you guys. It's, oh, it's so sweet. We'll have to link to it.
Well, definitely a really good moment for that team.
Yeah, definitely. And this is, you know, this is just the most recent example we've seen. But throughout history, sports have been an avenue for social change, especially when it comes to combating racism. So, Maeve, why don't you give us a couple historical examples of this?
Yeah, so just a quick rundown of some of the most famous examples of athlete activism. Really, we can start with Jackie Robinson, who was the Black baseball player who broke the color barrier in 1947. He was the first African-American to play in Major League Baseball. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Something that really struck me is that this happened 17 years before the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So while obviously Jackie Robinson didn't walk onto the team and then all of the race problems in the MLB was solved, but in terms of an example of how sports can be such a progressive place, I thought that this is a really good example of how it happens in sports first and brings it into the public consciousness. Definitely. Then, of course, another major moment of bringing race relations into the public consciousness was the Black Power Salute at 1968's Mexico City Olympics. And this was two track stars, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, and they placed first and third. And they were up on the podium and they raised the Black Power salute. In that same era, Muhammad Ali, one of the most outspoken advocates of his era, maybe one of the most outspoken athletes ever, He was a very vocal opponent of the Vietnam War. He refused to be drafted. And he was also a repeated champion for racial justice. So he is kind of the predecessor to a lot of other very admirable athletes like Jesse Owens, Bill Russell, Jack Johnson, Althea Gibson, Jim Brown, Dave Megacy, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And this is not even an exhaustive list. So obviously throughout history, a very proud lineage of athletes being activists for social and racial change.
Definitely. We're mostly going to focus on the modern era of athlete activism, which starts off in about 2012 and is more recently covered by the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement. Some examples of athlete activism in this period, a lot of them are coming about as a result of what people see as unjustified deaths of Black African Americans in the U.S., and a lot of that related to police brutality. So starting in 2012 with the murder of Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, so in 2012, after the death of Trayvon Martin, Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, and other members of the Miami Heat team donned hoodies and put their hands in their pockets for a photo that they posted to Instagram in solidarity with Trayvon. He, of course, is the Black teenager who was killed in a gated community in Florida while he was carrying Skittles and iced tea. He was shot by George Zimmerman, who ultimately was never convicted. And many of the Heat players said it hit really close to home as they thought about their own sons. And they really echoed the sentiment that Obama said of, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And another notable part of this is that the Heat's coach, Eric Spoelstra, supported their actions and he called it a powerful move.
Yeah, that's awesome. So then the next time we saw this sort of athlete speaking out was in November 2014, when the St. Louis Rams entered the stadium in the hands up, don't shoot pose. Basically in solidarity with the protesters in Ferguson, which has continued to be, you know, the hotbed of some of these racial tensions and issues going on.
Then just a month later in December 2014, LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, and Kyrie Irving all put on I Can't Breathe t-shirts, which commemorated the last words of Eric Garner, who was the New York man who was suffocated to death by police officers after selling cigarettes illegally. This was obviously a really powerful statement, and these are some of the biggest players in the NBA wearing these shirts during their warmups. My one question was why they used Comic Sans font. It just seemed, it's like a font that doesn't really speak to the gravity of the message, but I guess that the message got through anyway.
And then in May 2015, Carmelo Anthony walked in a Baltimore peace march after the death of Freddie Gray, who died while being transported in a police van, apparently died of a spinal cord injury when officers didn't assist him as he was rolling around in the back of the van. And so Carmelo Anthony walked in this march wearing a shirt that said Cassius Clay on it, which is the name of the birth name of Muhammad Ali, who, as we previously discussed, was very involved in these types of movements. What I liked about this example is that Carmelo Anthony, after Freddie Gray's death, there were all kinds of like riots and violence in the streets of Baltimore. And Carmelo Anthony said that he participated in this demonstration as a means for trying to encourage peace in the city. He grew up in West Baltimore, and so he was trying to use his influence to have people be calm and be peaceful in their protests. But it's also interesting to look at, these have all been examples of professional athletes engaging with the different movements around all of these issues. But there are also examples in the college world, and particularly in the women's college athletics world. The Notre Dame women's basketball team, when they were ranked fifth nationally, warmed up against their game against Michigan wearing I Can't Breathe t-shirts. And that made them, I think, what appears to be the first group of female athletes to do that. So kind of just showing that like this goes beyond one subset. You know, everyone's affected by this, and like female athletes are going to do their part to take a stand as well. And then shortly after that, the University of California women's basketball team wore shirts that read Black Lives Matter and We Are Cal. And then on the front of their shirts, they had duct tape with the names of Black Americans who have either been lynched or killed by police. So taking it sort of one step further, not just the name of the movement, the name of the hashtag, but also like calling out specific instances and specific people who they feel have been unjustly killed.
Yeah. I mean, so far, all of our examples of college athletes have been really positive ones. But that has not been the case across the board if we look at the Oregon Ducks. There are those who still do not think that sports are the appropriate venue for activism. And Oregon basketball coach Dana Altman is one of them. He said after some of his athletes had participated in activism and in promoting some of these causes, he said, on their own as individuals, they have that right. As part of our basketball team, when you put the Oregon jersey on, it's a little different. So I think there's a time and place for everything. I don't think that was the appropriate time. And he said this after two players had held their hands up in solidarity with protesters during the national anthem. And I think this one really struck me and kind of makes my blood boil, because it would be one thing if he was taking issue with players somehow disrespecting the national anthem, but he doesn't mention that. He only mentions their representation as Oregon Ducks. And in my opinion, they're really representing the Oregon Ducks and the university in a really great way of being aware and being conscious and being thoughtful students and participants in their community. And it just, again, with college sports, because of the fact that the students are not paid, and then Altman is making close to $2 million a year. And this was also, he made these comments during a season where 8 of his 15 players were Black. So his livelihood is being made pretty comfortably on the backs of these kids. And then in the meantime, in January 2015, Altman and the university were sued by a female student who alleged that they knew about her sexual assault by 3 basketball players but still allowed them to play. And Altman was also accused of ignoring previous reports of alleged sexual assault by one player while he was being recruited. The suit against Altman was later dismissed, and the university later settled with the student. But I just think it really calls into question his moral compass of what is and is not appropriate.
Well, it certainly also shows a disconnect between he and his students, and like so differently from the Missouri coach who had his players' backs and understands their struggle and wanted to support them in any way. It just seems like Altman is, you know, trying to prevent any kind of controversy and is blatantly ignoring all of the issues that are happening.
Just a disappointing example.
I mean, it is really interesting to look at the complete continuum from organizations who, you know, support their players, support their opinions, support their need to speak out about their opinions. And then on the other hand, the organizations that are just like, no, please just like, don't say anything and like stay quiet and like do your job as athletes.
That's what was happening in Cleveland, right? I mean, you were going to tell us about that one.
Exactly. Okay, so in Cleveland, a wide receiver named Andrew Hawkins wore a practice shirt before a home game that read Justice for Tamir Rice and John Crawford III, who are 2 young African-American males who were shot by police in 2 separate occasions. Tamir Rice is 12 years old, and John Crawford III was 22. But basically, the Cleveland Police Patrolman Union president spoke out and said, it's pretty pathetic when athletes think they know the law. They should stick to what they know best on the field. The Cleveland Police protect and serve the Browns Stadium, and the Browns organization owes us an apology. And then the Browns actually stood by their player, Hawkins, saying that they endorse the rights of players to protect their support and bring awareness to issues that are important to them if done so in a responsible manner, which they deemed wearing a t-shirt was a responsible manner. Yeah. So this sort of falls on the on the continuum of, you know, the organization completely back to their player. They support their freedom of speech. And it's, I mean, it is kind of a bold thing to say when the police are directly calling for an apology, but I like that.
Yeah, I think it's really heartening when the organizations behind these players really unify and make sure that they are protected and that their voices can be heard. And I think that this is a sentiment that's echoed by Michelle Roberts, who's the president of the NBA Players Association. And she was asked to comment on recent activity by a lot of NBA players, which we've talked about already, about the Black Lives Matter movement and other forms of activism. And she said, quote, "It may be that we're hearing more from players because this has been an especially active couple of years in terms of issues that not surprisingly would get their attention. It's actually refreshing to see the players not merely be engaged in their business, and that is basketball, but to express themselves as members of our community." And I think that that is so eloquently
said.
Amen. And she is just one of my favorite people. But I think that she is doing a great job in her position as a spokesman for, as a spokeswoman for these players, to protect their status not only as professional basketball players, but also as influencers and role models and people who have unique experiences. A lot of the NBA, it's estimated that about 3/4 of NBA players are Black. So they're obviously representatives of their communities. And I really applaud her for her statements and her support of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
This contrasts a bit with Adam Silver, who's the president of the NBA. And we have previously praised him on this podcast for being a relatively proactive leader, especially surrounding the domestic abuse incidents. But on this take, he was kind of more measured in his assessment. He said that while he supports the players' activism, he doesn't necessarily think that games have to be the platform. He said, "I think our players have so many other opportunities and have a platform to express their points of view on a variety of issues, so it doesn't necessarily need to be within the four corners of our playing surface." And I can't really decide if he's right here.
I get it. I mean, I think I would definitely defend Adam Silver because I think he's done an amazing job so far. And especially with like the Donald Sterling, when Donald Sterling, the owner of the Clippers, was caught making a lot of racial slurs and some really horrible, disparaging comments. Adam Silver spoke up and made him an example, barring him from the NBA, fining him $2.5 million, which was the maximum possible, and making him sell the Clippers. So I feel like on so many levels, Adam Silver, like, he gets it. He respects it. I would support him probably on this one because I just feel like there is a certain extent to which, you know, you have to be able to play the game. Like, distractions can be an issue, but I don't feel like wearing t-shirts and warm-ups is a problem. I have a feeling he was like hedging bets in case, you know, it got more distracting from the game.
Yeah, I think that the thing that struck me about his comments is that when you're looking at your body of players who, you know, about 3/4 of them are Black, and to kind of ask them to divorce their experiences as Black people in America from their profession, I think is a difficult thing
to do. I don't think that's what he's doing.
I don't think that he's explicitly saying that, but I think that there's kind of an undertone to his comments. He didn't come out and explicitly say that he supports all of their activism anytime, any place. Like you said, he hedged his bets a little bit, but you know, I just think that it's an interesting commentary on kind of like what our expectations of athletes are. Should they strictly be playing the game, or should they use the game as a platform for other causes? And do we mean the game as in the actual game in the stadium being televised, or do we mean the game as in their participation in a league which gives them a certain fame and platform?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that the NBA has been more allowing of players expressing their opinions, like, in and around the game environment. The NFL has been handing out fines left and right anytime a player wants to make any kind of statement. And it seems like the NFL or the NBA has sort of let that go a little bit and been more lenient on that kind of thing. Okay, so far we've been talking a lot about the administrations and the coaches supporting their players and speaking out, but there's also this whole other aspect of the fans and what they want to see from athletes. There's certainly an attitude among some fans that players are there for their entertainment. They should stick to what they know. They should shut up and play. And they should really just keep any other opinions to themselves. And I honestly feel like this is the same subset of humans and sports fans who can watch a Dallas Cowboys game and cheer for Greg Hardy without domestic violence even crossing their minds, you know? So it's the people who see sports as this, like, untouchable sphere where nothing off the field or outside of the arena exists or matters at all.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's impossible or naive or even just irresponsible to compartmentalize this so completely and to forget that athletes are fully formed humans as well who have to deal with social and racial and cultural issues in their daily lives. So of course they're going to use their stature to have this dialogue when they feel it's necessary.
Definitely. And, you know, I think that that brings up that in putting together this episode, we read a lot of comparisons between today's athletes and those of previous eras. And it brings up this really interesting trend. For example, as you were talking about, that some fans want their players to just play and not be involved in activism. There was this article in Vice, for instance, that argued that there was a period of almost complacency in the 80s and 90s when Black athletes were becoming really astronomically rich, and that the argument goes some were hesitant to rock the boat on that or anger their sponsors, anger their coaches, anger their teams. And those who did, like Craig Hodges, for example, found themselves out of the league. And whether this is explicitly because of their political beliefs or a range of other factors, it's hard to say objectively. But Craig Hodges, for example, is very convinced that his release from the league was directly tied to his political engagement. Or, for example, a kind of more famous player, Michael Jordan. There's criticism of him that he chose commerce over conscience, basically, and that he used his power as a spokesperson to sell sneakers and not to address any types of societal inequities. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was also a prominent player during a similar time, was known to try to influence him to speak out more. And I think that this brings up this interesting question of, like, well, for the athletes who do want to be spokespeople, then that's their prerogative and we stand behind that. But for athletes who don't, do they have a responsibility? You know, why shouldn't Michael Jordan just be able to sell sneakers?
Right, exactly. Is it like a to each his own thing, or is there a responsibility that comes with being a prominent athlete?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think that this applies to celebrity in general. And the other comparison of today's athletes and their responsibility to leverage social change came from the 1965 American Football League All-Star Game in New Orleans, when Black players boycotted the game after receiving explicitly racist treatment upon their arrival in the city. So some commentators were saying that today's athletes actually aren't even doing enough and they should be boycotting games and taking more extreme steps and things like that.
In the AFL example, there was a specific objective that they were trying to achieve. And I feel like the difference with the athletes speaking out now is that the objective they want is, you know, an end to racism, which, of course, is what everyone wants. But it's not so easy to, like, there isn't a specific organizing body that just has to relent and be like, okay, that's enough pressure. Like, I give in, you know, now we're talking about these huge systemic issues that have, you know, immensely complex historical components. And there's no one who can give in and be like, okay, yes, this is how it's going to be moving forward. And so in that sense, I feel like this is more of the long game of athletes being involved in activism, and they need to keep doing what they're doing and keep drawing attention to issues when instances arise. And it's less about achieving one small achievable goal. It's more about changing the world, you know, and athletes participating in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's this impulse to tell athletes, like, do more, like, protest the games, use your leverage. But it's kind of like, okay, well, what's the next sentence? Like, what's your call to action? What do you want them to specifically protest? As you were saying, like, racism today is so ingrained in these socio and economic barriers that are often a proxy for racial discrimination. And, like, how do you want to address subconscious biases on this national scale? And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that there aren't explicit acts of racism anymore. You know, just look at the South Carolina church shooting. But it feels like our problems surrounding race today are much more sneaky and less blatant.
Yeah. Or the solutions just aren't there. You know, like, we can see that there are police-involved shootings and they're primarily against African Americans. That is a discrete problem, but the solution is not as clear right now.
Yeah. But I think that what you were saying about, you know, athletes are playing the long game, that reminds me of this great article that I read by Dave Zirin. He's popping up again. But he basically was writing about his brother-in-law and saying that his brother-in-law was really woken up to the current state of race in America because of the sports and the athletes that he watches. And he had a couple of really good quotes. He was talking about the power of athletes to influence others. And he says that speaks to why Black and brown athletes have historically always been policed by the media and sports owners for their political statements. It's not the power of their words as much as the power of their reach. So kind of this notion of, like, winning hearts and minds. Can his brother-in-law, you know, vote for somebody different or, you know, donate to an organization because of his exposure through sports? And this article, like, basically summed up everything that I think about why sports is important to society and not just for entertainment. He said, bring this movement to fans, force people to reckon with worlds that they do not inhabit. We won't reach everyone. Some will respond with the ugliest possible reaction for daring to invade on their sacred sporting space, but some will actually also hear for the first time in their lives. And then this was a really powerful part. He said, by breaching the walls of the sports world, we can puncture the ultimate privilege in our society, the privilege of blissful ignorance.
Yes. Love that.
Yeah. And I think that that's so universal to so many of the themes and issues that we talk about on this podcast, not just race relations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that, like, sure, you can watch a football game and not realize any of this. But I think, yeah, athletics can be such a powerful way for people to learn about the issues that matter to their favorite players. You know, if that's where they're getting their news, at least it might spur them to do some Googling on their own and not live this sheltered existence.
Totally. But, you know, one last thing that I want to address, and Bryn, you can speak to this a little bit more, but we haven't really talked about that many women on this episode.
Yeah. And I think that certainly doesn't mean that female athlete activists don't exist. And it doesn't mean that female athletes don't care or think about these things. But as we've talked about on so many previous episodes, I think women, female athletes, understand that their platform is not as tall or broad as the male athletes. And so when they speak out, you know, they may not even get as much media attention. They probably won't get nearly as much media attention unless it's a time when the media is really turned toward them. So, but I think a lot of times female athletes and female sports teams will join in on larger movements in smaller ways, like the college athletes and Black Lives Matter, as opposed to speaking out and trying to rely on their level of fame to propel their issues forward.
Yeah, it's like female athletes and female sports teams are starting from behind already, where they need to work to just get to a place of respect and attention for their sport. And in that sense, it sometimes feels like female athletes make a political statement in just deciding
being female athletes
themselves to being an athlete.
Yeah.
So, you know, we certainly don't want to disregard all of the women out there who are, you know, being vocal, being active. But just understanding that the challenges and the platforms are really different.
Definitely. Well, let's take a quick break. And then our fierce lady this week is a female athlete who is active in social issues. So we'll come back and hear about her.
Sounds good.
Okay, welcome back. Today, our fierce lady is Ariana Smith, who is a Knox College female basketball player. So, Maeve, why don't you tell us about Ariana?
Yeah, so Ariana is now a former Knox College basketball player for reasons that we'll lay out. But basically, the story starts when they had a game soon after the Ferguson protests, and they were playing Fontbonne University in Clayton, Missouri, so really close to Ferguson. And just after the national anthem and before the game started, Ariana fell to her knees and she lied down for 4.5 minutes to commemorate the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown's body was left in the street. She then walked out of the gym with her fist in a black salute, and she was later suspended from the team by the athletic director. She was asked, was that purposeful distraction? So she goes down to practice to let her teammates know, and the coach said that she needed to leave, even though they have open practices. The coach threatened to call security, and she was ultimately escorted out of the building. And at this point, her teammates are now defending her, saying, you know, did you think she was going to be violent? Why would you make that assumption? Ultimately, her suspension was reversed when it got to the college president's office. But Ariana is convinced that this is only because the story had made its way to the media and the college had to save face. The school also has a slogan, freedom to flourish. And she mentioned this a couple times as being, you know, pretty ironic given the reaction and response to her. She decided that she would not return to the team because she felt like it wasn't a place anymore where she could grow and operate healthily. But she was hopeful now that other colleges like Notre Dame and Berkeley, that they've worn I Can't Breathe t-shirts and have taken other steps, some of which we mentioned earlier in the episode, and that they've really been met with applause. And she had this quote that I really liked. She said, when it comes down to it, yeah, they may be happy with a shirt, but what if one of their players decided to protest on the street? Would the support be as strong? I'm happy to see that there are positive responses, but I'm not sure about the intensity of the support, if that makes sense. You know, I'm just a person who's willing to make sacrifices, who's willing to take risks to see if larger conversations can be sparked. I'm willing to be the person to ask the first question with hopes that there are other people around me that are like-minded. And
yeah, I love that.
I mean, I think that luckily there are other people around her that are like-minded and that have been speaking out. Ariana
and
Smith.
That question of the intensity of the support, I think that's so crucial because it's like, it's so easy to tweet with a hashtag. It's so easy to like see someone in a t-shirt and be like, oh yeah, that's cool. But like when it comes down to it, I love that she's pushing people to actually make their opinions known and support people who are trying to be more than just like a casual activist.
Yeah, and obviously such a display of conviction on her part because first of all, it's women's basketball. So as much as we hate it, that's not going to be as popular as men's basketball. And it's not like she's playing for a powerhouse. Right. She's playing for Knox College. So, you know, there was nothing in it for her to take that stand except for her convictions and what she believes is right. So,
yeah, fierce
Ariana
lady.
Smith, fierce lady. Okay, well, I think that wraps it up for this week. So, Bryn, you want to tell them where they can find us?
Sure thing. All of our episodes are on iTunes and Stitcher, Not Your Boyfriend Sports Show. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter, we are at NYBF Sports. You can email us at nybfsports@gmail.com. And one of these days we'll have a website.
Very soon. Very, very soon. Okay. Well, Bryn, as always, a pleasure.
Just a delight. Good game, Maeve.
Good game, Bryn.